MacCast, Sunday, January 12th, 2020. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast in a brand new year. Hope you are doing fine and well. I have been suffering the slings and arrows of illnesses that have been going round and around and around. It's hit my workplace especially hard, but also got me a little bit over the holidays and been reeling from that. So hopefully you've been able to avoid all of that nastiness. But it is a new year, and we do have some great Mac and Apple news information to get into, and also some questions from you, along with a fun little thing of the moment in this episode. Lots of stuff to get into. Of course, 2020, which means the iPhone rumors are starting to begin, and also that because it's so early, they tend to be a little bit more on the, what's the nice way to put this, speculative side? The not nice way to put it is crazy side. Yeah, we'll get into some of those. We'll talk about GPUs and Apple chips. We'll talk a little bit about Apple TV and an exciting new partnership that happened over the last week or so. Also, growth of iPhone and Apple doing well. And then also a recall, a replacement program, really. Not a recall. That's not the right way to put it. A replacement program that's going on that some of you might want to know about, in case you have one of the affected products. So we'll get into all that in the news. Then we're going to talk about Apple Maps, follow up a little bit on what I talked about last episode of the MacCast. We're going to talk about making the most of the Activity app. I know a lot of people, myself included, you start a new year, maybe you want to take some new time to set some new goals. I'm not going to say New Year's resolutions, but, you know, new goals to maybe get a little bit healthier, do more in the new year, and the Activity app certainly can help out with that, but it can be a little bit confusing, and we had some questions about it. And so we'll dive into that. And I had a question about streaming and Apple TV. We'll dig into that. And what do you do when you run into problems cleaning the keyboard on your Mac? Yeah, I'll explain that. And then, like I said, I've got this great thing of the moment that came out of CES. I'm usually not big on things in CES, but something very interesting and relevant to the Apple community came out this year, and I thought it was pretty cool, and I thought I would share that with you. So that will round out this episode of the MacCast, so it should be a good one to start off the year. Before we get into things, though, I do want to take a quick moment and thank a show sponsor, and that is Linode. Linode lets you instantly deploy and manage an SSD server in the Linode cloud. You can get a server up and running literally in seconds with your choice of distribution of Linux, along with resources and your choice of 10 different node locations. As a matter of fact, they just opened their newest data center in Mumbai, India, and it is built using their most up-to-date hardware, next-generation backbone. Linode also allows you to comply with in-country data protection requirements by taking advantage of all of Linode's technologies and tools. And what's really cool is they're giving all new MacCast customers a $20 credit. And it certainly is more than just hosting. With Linode, you have all the options and choices you need to build the server you want with the service and features that you want. It's pretty amazing. Whatever you need in a server, you can build it on Linode. Dedicated CPU, distributed applications, hosted services, websites, and continuous integration and continuous delivery environments. They're all available to you, featuring native SSD storage, a 40 gigabit network, and industry-leading processors. You can pick from up to 10 different worldwide data centers, and best of all, their pricing is simple with no surprise fees. You pay for what you use with hourly billing across all of their plans and add-on services. And their new cloud manager, it's really nice. They improved on what they had before, and it was already amazing. It has an improved user interface, which makes managing your Linodes and upgrading your plan even easier than ever. And if you have the skills and are looking for a job right now, Linode is actually hiring. Check out linode.com/careers to check out their current career opportunities. So lots of great things going on with Linode. If you want to check it all out and take advantage of that $20 credit for being a MacCast listener, just visit linode.com/MacCast, sign up for your first Linode, and get a $20 credit. And a big thanks to Linode for their continued support of the MacCast. As I said at the beginning of the show, it is a new year, 2020. That means it is a new point for all of the sketchy iPhone rumors to begin. It's actually almost laughable at this point to think that any of these rumors are anything beyond just kind of random guesses about the future of maybe where the iPhone is going and how its design and features might look. Some of it backed up by maybe sketchy facts and some few rumors and innuendos coming out of the supply chain, but still they do bring up some interesting things for, I think, us to talk about. So far this year, the most far-fetched comes from Credit Suisse. Yes, the Swiss financial services company. They claim that a top-end iPhone in 2020 will drop Face ID, going back to Touch ID with an under the display sensor, but then they take it one step further and say that the TrueDepth camera system is also going to be moved under the display. The first red flag, I think, in this rumor for me is that that TrueDepth camera system that they're saying will be under the display, yeah, it's not going to feature Face ID. So technically, that means it's not a TrueDepth camera. That's the whole point of the TrueDepth camera, is that it has the dot projector and it's used for Face ID technology. So it'd basically be Apple rolling back to just a FaceTime camera for doing the front-facing video and FaceTime calls and all that fun stuff. So I think they're a little bit off on this one. The likely more accurate rumor here, in my opinion, is that Apple really, really wants to get to the point where they realize Johnny Ive's vision for the iPhone, which was a single slab of glass with just a display on the front. And I think they are trying to get there, and I think that's where the genesis of these rumors come from. As a matter of fact, Ming-Chi Kuo had said in the past that Apple would likely move back to an under-display fingerprint sensor, or move to, rather, an under-display fingerprint sensor. That's something that was rumored they had always wanted to do from the very get-go, but they could never really get it working, and the technology still is relatively unproven. But at least Ming-Chi Kuo has the foresight to understand that Apple would probably do the fingerprint sensor in addition to Face ID, because it really makes sense to have both of them. Each has their own limits, right? For a fact, we know that Touch ID does not work very great if you live in a cold environment where you have to wear gloves. Face ID is much better for that scenario. But there are other times when maybe you don't want to have to look at your display. You'd like to be able to just unlock using a fingerprint. So advantages to both. Bloomberg has also supported the theory that Apple would move to under-display authentication, and so I think they are trying to get there. As far as when they'll get there, that's a little bit up for debate. Kuo thinks it will be in 2021. Bloomberg thinks it could possibly be as early as 2020, but even they hedge their bets and go for 2021. And that's because that under-display fingerprint tech is really problematic, as we've seen with Samsung, and no one seems to have really solved some of the security issues to date. I think if anybody could pull it off, it is going to be Apple. They're dedicated to that kind of security, and they're not going to roll something in that out that doesn't meet their very high standards. So I think that's why we haven't seen it yet. I think that's also why we might not see it in 2020. Of course, there also now exists at least some early examples of cameras that can be installed under displays, but as far as I know, they're very, very early stage. No one really has something that's ready for prime time to be delivered to consumers. As a matter of fact, I remember way back when Apple had a patent where the whole display could become a camera, with the sensor pixels kind of squeezed in between the display pixels. So you basically have the screen doing double duty. Of course, I don't think that technology is even anywhere close to early stage or ready for prime time. So I don't think that's something we're going to see anytime soon. But it does give you, again, some insight into the direction and the things that Apple are thinking about and would like to bring out. So I think we will get there, but not going to happen anytime soon. And certainly with these early rumors, it is too early to be making those kinds of predictions for iPhones in 2020. One thing that is very likely to happen with displays, though, is that they could get thinner. As a matter of fact, LG has announced some new technology that would allow the touch layer to be integrated directly into an OLED panel without the need for a separate layer, meaning the displays could be thinner. It may or may not mean that the iPhone actually gets thinner this year. More likely, Apple would use the extra space for other technology, probably more battery, but it is a sign of a next-gen technology that we could see in a 2020 iPhone. Apple has ordered LG displays in the past. They have a few display suppliers, so I think you'd have to have the tech across the board, but interesting to think about, again, nonetheless. And then finally, another rumor that is a little bit out there and really pretty crazy is that Apple could split the iPhone 12 launch between two separate dates in 2020 because of 5G technology. There's a rumor saying that they could ship the first ones in September with the slower sub 6 gigahertz technology, and then that would be followed up later in the year, possibly in December, by the new faster mmWave 5G technology, and that might even spill over into 2021. This one, I don't put any stake behind. Apple is going to go with the best 5G technology that they have available for their devices when they want to ship them in the fall. They're not going to split up that release. It's just not going to happen. It's not what Apple does. If they do roll out a slower version, sub 6 gigahertz, and that's what rolls out in September, then we will see the mmWave the next year in the next release. It would be an iPhone 13. I would hope that they're able to get the newer technology out and ready in the fall, but we'll just have to wait and see on that one. But I really wouldn't put much stake behind this rumor. So there you go, some early kind of crazy rumors about the iPhone. I'm sure this is only the beginning. As a matter of fact, I'm positive this is only the beginning because, again, we're starting a new year and iPhones are what a lot of this community likes to speculate on and talk about. Here's a blast from Apple's past, Imagination Technologies. Do you remember those guys? You probably do if you had an older iPhone. Back in the day, Apple worked with Imagination Technologies as a partner. They supplied GPU chips and technology for the iPhone. Then back in 2018, Apple switched to using their own designs, starting with the A11 chip, and Imagination suffered the loss of Apple and their business. As a matter of fact, it hit them so hard that they ended up selling, and the company was later bought by a Silicon Valley-based firm. And now it's looking like Apple may have reached a new licensing deal. There was a lot of back and forth between Imagination and Apple. As a matter of fact, some pretty sour grapes. And now that the old guard is gone at Imagination, I guess the new folks want to do a deal. Imagination announced that it has replaced their old multi-year, multi-use license agreement with Apple with a new deal that will give Apple access to a wider range of Imagination's intellectual property in exchange for licensing fees. No other details are really known about the arrangement at this point, but Imagination recently did announce that they have their 10th generation PowerVR graphics chip architecture called IMG A-series processors ready to go in 2020. The company claims that the new chips due out later this year will offer 2.5 times the performance, 8 times faster machine learning processing, and use 60% lower power consumption than their current PowerVR chips that are out in devices now. It's not clear if Apple will move from their own custom-designed GPUs back to using PowerVR tech, or maybe they just want access to license the technology for integration into their own designs, or it could be something else entirely different. They could want PowerVR chips for another product, not necessarily iPhones or iPads, but maybe something like their possible rumored AR glasses. Only time is going to tell, but what we do know is that they've patched things up with Imagination and have this deal in place for future Apple tech. Some possible good news for the future of Apple TV Plus content. According to the New York Times, Apple has secured a 5-year deal with Eden Productions to produce TV shows, documentaries, and feature films exclusively for Apple TV Plus. The good part of this is that Eden is a new company run by former HBO CEO Richard Pelpler. He was at HBO when they won more than 160 Emmy Awards and had many hit series like Game of Thrones, Big Little Lies, and Veep. In interviews, it seems like Pelpler decided to go with Apple because they are just starting out, and he thinks that his production company could, quote, make a little contribution there. So he seems excited about the fact that Apple is a smaller player and thinks that they have an opportunity to possibly make a bigger impact at Apple with Apple TV Plus than they might be able to do in other venues. And that's pretty cool. Another cool thing is that Pelpler has had some experience working with Apple and their team when they launched HBO Now, so he knows kind of how that working relationship works, and I'm pretty excited to see what they put together. I like the fact that it's an exclusive deal. Apple hasn't had too many of those with Apple TV Plus to date, and of course, we all know that they could use a little more content on their service. So I will be excited to see what is coming out from Eden and Apple's partnership. And in more Apple TV news, you will soon have more places and more ways to watch Apple TV Plus content. That's because LG says that they will be adding support for Apple's TV app to their webOS smart TV platform sometime this year. The app will be available on its newest 2020 OLED and NanoCell TVs, as well as on older 2018 and 2019 models. They haven't given an exact date on when it will be released, so only time will tell there. LG has had a little bit of a rough start with Apple fans because they did announce AirPlay 2 and HomeKit support for their televisions, but only rolled that support back to 2019 and newer TVs, citing technical limitations. That will not be the case with the Apple TV app rolling all the way back to 2018 models. So if you own a LG TV currently or are looking at buying a new one, you may have, again, another place to watch your Apple TV content. Finally, some good news for Apple in China. Looks like they have seen some significant growth in that region. This is according to official Chinese government data. Apple saw iPhone sales growth of 18.7% in December. That's pretty incredible and actually up significantly from the 6% year-on-year growth that they saw in the September and October timeframes. It's estimated that they sold 3.18 million iPhone units in China in December and believed that the iPhone 11's release is the thing that most significantly contributed to that uptick. It's good news for Apple in the region, especially given the fact that smartphone shipments in the country were down more than 13% year on year, so Apple is bucking the trend there. Bloomberg does note that Apple may not continue to see growth as more 5G devices begin to hit the market in China in the coming months, but they should make up for that when they release their own 5G models sometime in the September or October timeframe. And then finally, in the news for this week, if you have an iPhone XS, XS Max, or our battery case, smart battery case, Apple has announced a new replacement program for you. Apparently, some smart battery cases can experience charging issues, including cases that will not charge or charge intermittently when you plug them into power, or cases that will not charge an iPhone or charge that iPhone intermittently. So basically, just every kind of charging program, one way or the other, that you might have with a smart battery case. Again, this is limited to iPhone XS, XS Max, and XR smart cases, not any other model, so does not impact any of the iPhone 11s. Affected smart battery cases were actually manufactured between January 2019 and October 2019. So if you think you have an impacted case, you will want to contact Apple or an Apple authorized service provider, and they can determine if your case is eligible, and if so, it will be replaced for free. So if you have that, you probably want to log into Apple's support website to get more details and find out all of the steps you need to take to get a new case. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank another show sponsor, and that is ExpressVPN. You know, we've talked in the past about the advantages of using a VPN. It is certainly great for protecting your security, protecting your privacy when you're surfing online, when you're out and about, you're at that coffee shop, you're at that hotel. You definitely want a great VPN, and ExpressVPN has been my VPN of choice for about a year now. I really do love how easy it is to use. You just simply install the app, choose the VPN location you want, and click a button, and you are safe and secure. It is really that easy. Plus, the connection is fast and reliable. And it also works with all of my Macs and devices, Mac, iPad, iPhone. It's got you covered across the board. And that certainly is great and certainly is reason enough to get ExpressVPN. But I recently had another need for ExpressVPN, and it came in handy once again. You know, I run in nerd circles. Yeah, big surprise. And many, many of my friends are huge fans of Doctor Who. I've never really gotten into it. It's been on my streaming list for a while, and I've never really gotten around to watching it until I decided, hey, I need something to watch. I'm going to jump in and do it. I thought it was on Netflix, but turns out it was pulled in 2016. I then read that it was available on Amazon Prime. Great, went over there, but that got pulled there a few months ago as well. So incredibly frustrating. Then I heard it was still available on Netflix, but in the UK. Guess what? Using ExpressVPN, I could connect to their UK VPN and was able to access and watch Doctor Who on Netflix. And ExpressVPN has access in almost 100 different countries, so it can do the same for your favorite shows and content as well. And best of all, if you visit my special link right now, expressvpn.com/maccast, you can get an extra 3 months of ExpressVPN for free. So you can support the show, you can watch what you want, and you can protect yourself at expressvpn.com/maccast. That's expressvpn.com/maccast. Get 3 extra months for free. And a big thank you to ExpressVPN for their support of the Maccast. I think we're going to have to kick off the feedback portion here with somewhat of an apology, because I try to pride myself here on the Maccast of doing a pretty good job of bringing you accurate and vetted information. And I feel like I failed you a little bit in not thoroughly checking something that I talked about on the last episode of the Maccast. Last time, I mentioned that we had reports from several Apple news sources that Apple had completed their map updates in the US for their new enhanced maps as promised by the end of 2019. There were several sites that I trust reporting that this completion was done, that the rollout was finished with the expansion of the enhanced mapping into Alaska and the central and southeast portions of the United States. And I kind of took their word for it. I didn't really pop open Apple. Well, I take that back. I did pop open Apple Maps. I kind of poked around a little bit. It looked correct to me, but I didn't kind of zoom in all the way and really check thoroughly. And after my report, many of you emailed in to say that you were not seeing the enhancements in your areas. And I was a little bit shocked by that. But sure enough, went back in, and it seems especially true in the more rural areas of the central and southeast portions of the United States. As a matter of fact, if you open up the Maps app, and I totally should have caught this, you can see the deficiencies. All you have to do is look across the board, and you can kind of see the big way to tell where it has the enhanced features is if you see a lot more shades of green across the map versus the just beige. And when you open up Apple Maps and you look at the United States, you can see the northeast portion of the U.S. is pretty well covered. You can see the entire western portion of the map pretty well covered. But coming from about Minnesota down to Florida, or actually North Dakota down to Florida, you can see it's pretty well not those different shades of green. And sure enough, if you zoom in on a lot of cities, even some of the bigger cities like Minneapolis, St. Paul, you will find regions where they don't have things like the building outlines. They're not showing the waterways. They're not showing the park enhancements that Apple is claiming to have had. Now, I think it is important to point out that these reports were coming from Mac news websites and not from any official statements made by Apple. Apple had officially said that they would complete the rollout by the end of 2019. This was earlier, but they never made a statement or any kind of press release at the end of the year to say that they had accomplished the rollout. So my guess is that it's still not fully rolled out in the U.S. They also said that they were going to try and roll it out more internationally in 2020. So I'm thinking that maybe they're still a little bit behind. So that to me looks like the current state of affairs. I'm not really sure how these reports got rolled out. I think they were hearing stuff from some of their audiences, and they probably should have done some deeper fact checking as well. But, you know, for my part, that was on me. I made the mistake, and I wanted to make that correction here at the start of the feedback section of the podcast. Starting off a new year, I think one of the things that a lot of us might do is sort of make a commitment to try and change maybe some of our habits in our lives. And one of those things that you might do is decide that, hey, I want to do a little bit more exercise. I want to be more active. Maybe I want to eat a little bit better. I want to get healthier. I know that's something that I am working on. I went back and joined a gym. I had been doing very well about a year ago. I had lost a bunch of weight, was walking every day, and then I went back to work and kind of fell off the horse a little bit. And so I'm ready to get back into it. And when I was doing it, I can honestly say that a great motivator for me was my Apple Watch and the activity tracking. And the activity app is really great, but it can be, I think, a little bit of a black box. And what got me thinking about this week is I received an email from someone asking me, hey, how do you adjust the activity goals on the iPhone, on the Apple Watch? When you're using the activity app and an Apple Watch, you kind of have these daily goals set for you in terms of your movement, your exercise, and your stand goals. And so the question was, hey, how do I change that stuff? How do I adjust those goals? And the first thing is that you really can't on the iPhone. There really is no way to adjust those goals on the iPhone. And also, there is only a single one of those goals that you can adjust, and you can adjust it with the activity app on the Apple Watch. So you're not allowed to do it on the iPhone for some reason. I'm not really sure why, but on the Apple Watch, you actually can adjust the move goal. And the way you do that is you adjust the daily calorie count or calorie goal on the Apple Watch. And you can either set it to what you currently want to burn, or maybe you can set it a little bit higher as kind of a future goal of a calorie count that you want to get to. And the way that you set it on the Apple Watch is you open up the activity app, on the Apple Watch, and then you just press firmly on the screen. And you can then tap the change move goal option and then adjust the number of calories up or down and tap update. And that will lock it in and that will be your new goal. Now, as you work toward that move goal and you achieve it, it will automatically adjust for you and move up as you're doing more and more movement and activity. The exercise goal and the stand goal, those really can't be adjusted. The exercise goal is locked in at 30 minutes a day. That's kind of the baseline. Of course, you can always do more. You can definitely always exceed the goals. And the stand goal is set to 12 stands a day. And we'll talk a little bit about what those things mean in a second, because it really got me thinking about, great, we have these goals, but how do they actually work? And really, what does it take to achieve them? So we'll kind of go through them one by one and try and explain them a little bit, starting with that move goal. Like I said, the move goal is the number of calories you are trying to burn per day, but it's not just any calories. It's what they call active calories. And active calories are ones that you burn while being active and moving around. I guess it kind of makes sense. It's right in the name there. But it's really not that straightforward, because it doesn't just have to be exercise. It just means when you're moving and moving around a little bit more vigorously than, say, sitting in a chair, just kind of, you know, typing at a computer. You have to be moving a little bit more than that, but you don't have to be doing a full-blown workout. So walking around the house, maybe working in the garden, those sorts of things will count towards your active calories. And when you burn those active calories, those will be put toward your move goal. So that will move the little red ring around on your Apple Watch. The second thing that you have is that exercise goal. Like I already said, it's a 30-minute a day exercise goal. And the way it works is that for every full minute of movement that equals or exceeds a brisk walk, so you have to be doing a little bit of exercise, but everything above a brisk walk, you are going to get credit for. Now, there's kind of a little bit of a caveat to that as well, because to get your exercise credits, Apple says you need to be kind of swinging your arm with your Apple Watch in a natural motion. So you need to be moving around. If you're doing your exercise and, say, pushing a stroller, so your arm's not moving, what you're going to want to do is actually start a workout using the workout app and set it up so that it knows that you're actually exercising so that you can get that credit. Now, there are a bunch of different types of workouts that you can do. So you can do like outdoor walks, indoor walks, swims, runs, bikes, all that sort of stuff. I mean, they have tons of different workouts that you can do. But one other tip that I will give you is that if you want to get credit just for the amount of time and not based on any other sensors or readings that you have on your Apple Watch, you can choose the workout called Other. And this will log time as a brisk walk, even if the sensors aren't detecting that. So it's kind of a little hack around. Now, with that, you would be on your honor that you're actually exercising, but at least you can make sure that you are getting credit if you are doing some form of exercise that maybe doesn't fit into the mold of what Apple has in terms of actual, you know, workouts or exercise regimes. So, you know, there it would just be, again, any activity that is above a brisk walk counts toward your exercise goal. And then finally, you have that stand goal. You can complete your daily stand goal by standing up and moving around for at least 1 minute during 12 different hours of the day. So you have to actually be a little bit active again, not, you know, jogging around or anything like that, but you have to be doing movement. So it's a little bit confusing, because a lot of people think, well, I stood up, you know, why didn't I get credit? No, you actually need to move around a little bit. Just standing won't work. So Yeah, a bit confusing because it's in the name stand, but you need to be doing a little bit more than that. And if you do all of those, you will achieve your goals. Again, I probably didn't mention the colors. You know, these are represented by the rings on your Apple Watch. So you have the move goal, which is the red ring. You have the exercise goal, which is the green ring, and then you have the stand goal, which is the blue ring. And of course, you get kind of awards and achievements for achieving each one of those. Also, if you sort of double your move goal or exercise goal, you're going to get bonus achievements. It ends up being a lot of fun because it kind of gamifies the whole exercise thing. A few other things to know about activity and achieving your goals. Wrist detection. This is a feature that needs to be on if you want to get some of your goals. If wrist detection is off, for example, you're not going to get any stand notifications and your Apple Watch can't actually track your stand progress. Also, background heart rate readings for resting and walking rates won't work with wrist detection turned off. So this is definitely a feature if you're working toward your activity goals that you probably want to make sure is turned on. To do it, you need to open up the Apple Watch app on your iPhone, tap on the My Watch tab, and then tap passcode, and then make sure that the wrist detection feature is turned on. Another thing you probably want to do is make sure that your Apple Watch is actually calibrated so that you can get credit for some of these activities. First thing to do would be make sure that calibration is turned on. It should be on by default, but you can check it by going on your iPhone, opening up the Settings app, tapping on Privacy, and then going to Location Services. You need to make sure that Location Services are turned on, and then scroll down and tap System Services, and in there, make sure that the Motion Calibration and Distance option is turned on. So that will activate calibration, and then to actually calibrate your device, what Apple recommends is that while wearing your Apple Watch, you go out to a flat, open outdoor area that has good GPS reception and clear skies. If you have an Apple Watch Series 2 or later, you just need the Apple Watch because those are the ones with the built-in GPS. If you have a Series 1 or earlier, you want to bring your iPhone with you because it will use your iPhone for the GPS. And Apple recommends in that scenario that you actually hold your iPhone in your hand or wear it on an arm or wristband because I think it's also going to use the motion of your hand to kind of set up the stride that you have as you're walking around. So all of these go into sort of calibrating your device. And then what you're going to want to do is open up the workout app and start an outdoor walk or an outdoor run and set a goal before starting TAP. So you can set a goal in terms of time or an open goal, whatever you want. I probably just do time because you want to do 20 minutes. So do a 20-minute walk and then walk or run at your normal pace for about 20 minutes. You don't have to do the 20 minutes all at once. It can be done over multiple sessions if you need, but then that should set up the calibration on your device. If you ever need to reset the calibration data, you can on your iPhone. You just open up the Apple Watch app. Again, tap the My Watch tab, then tap on Privacy, and you should see an option for reset fitness calibration data. Obviously, if you do that, you're going to have to go back and do this calibration procedure where you walk over a 20-minute walk over a flat open area. And that's pretty much it. And then, you know, you can use the activity app to track your progress, set your daily or see what your daily goals are, see how you're working towards achieving them, what you need to work on at the end of the day. And like I said, it is a really kind of great motivator. Another thing you can do with the activity app, of course, is you can follow your friends who are also doing workouts and activity and even challenge them to, you know, little daily challenges if you'd like. So you can gamify it as much or as little as you want. And like I said, when I was using it, I did find it pretty motivational. I was really skeptical at first, but once I got into it, it was a lot of fun, and I found that it was, for me at least, a little bit easier to kind of keep up with my goals. As I said, I fell off a little bit. I'm planning on getting back on that horse, and many of you might be doing so as well, so I thought this was a great topic of conversation here early in the year. And if you have extra kind of tips and features related to this topic, be it Apple Watch, the activity app, or I know there's a lot of great third-party apps out there that a lot of people like to use, I'd love your tips and recommendations. Feel free to send those in either as an email or better yet, as an audio comment to maccast@gmail.com. And I look forward to hearing from you. So I've actually owned every Apple TV since the original Apple TV. So something came up this week that I honestly didn't really think about as being something that we would talk about here on the MacCast. But Scott got a new Apple device in his family. He emailed me and said because he now has this new device, he also qualifies for a free year of Apple TV Plus, and he wanted to know if it was possibly worth it to add an Apple TV to his life so that they could actually stream that content easily to a television. And I guess the thing that I didn't think about was that there are people out there that maybe don't do a lot of streaming. And Scott was the first to admit to me, he's like, I just don't have a lot of experience with streaming. It's not anything that we've really been interested in. But now that we have this, I am curious about it. And he had basically two questions. He said, since I have just an HD TV, if I do decide to purchase an Apple TV, is it worth it to get the Apple TV 4K, or is the HD version just fine? And then also, and more generally, he said, you know, what's the advantage of having an Apple TV for streaming? There's lots of different ways that you can stream, so why Apple TV versus some other option that maybe, frankly, is less expensive? And I thought these were great questions to bring up on the show. So I'm going to start with the first question. You know, if you are in the market for a new Apple TV, you have two choices, right? You have the Apple TV 4K or you have the Apple TV HD. And so the question becomes, 2 4K or not 2 4K? That really is the question. And honestly, I had not looked at Apple TVs in a while. I have an Apple TV fourth generation, so basically what amounts to the HD version in my life. I don't have a 4K. But if you look now, what you have for Apple TVs is you have those two different options and you have three different storage sizes. So I'm going to set aside the storage size question for a second here and simply focus on HD versus 4K. And so at the bottom end, your options are Apple TV HD, 32 gigabytes of storage for $149 US. And for that, you get an Apple TV with an A8 processor, 100 base T and Ethernet, Bluetooth 4.0, and one that supports Dolby Digital Plus 7.1 surround sound audio. So that's that model. Then you have the comparable model in the 4K version, 32 gigabytes of storage, a price of $179 US, and that gets you an Apple TV 4K with a A10 processor, gigabit Ethernet, Bluetooth 5.0, and it supports up to Dolby Atmos sound. So significantly more technology in there for not a very large increase in price. They also, again, now let's talk about that storage. The Apple TV 4K also comes in a 64 gigabyte version, and that's just the built-in storage, so what you have available for storing your apps and things like that. And so we'll talk about, you know, the storage thing in a second, but just in that decision, do I buy an Apple TV HD because, hey, maybe I don't have a 4K TV. I'm not planning on buying a 4K TV. Do I really need to spend the extra money? Honestly, for me, I think with the only $30 price difference between the HD and the 4K, there is almost no reason to buy the HD version at this point because, again, you're getting a much better processor. A8 to A10. You are getting gigabit Ethernet versus 100 base T, Bluetooth 5 versus Bluetooth 4. And even if you don't use any of those technologies today, just the future proofing, in my opinion, is worth $30. Maybe 2, 3, 4, 5 years from now, you do want some of those technologies. And why not have a device that you've paid for already that supports that stuff? You could argue, well, maybe, Adam, there's going to be an 8K Apple TV by that time, you know, by the time that rolls around. Well, at least you might want to move that older device to another TV or, you know, reuse it in some way. And I just think, again, you're not paying a lot more for a lot better technology. So that's just my two cents. You might disagree with me. Real quickly on the storage thing, if you do go with the 4K Apple TV, do you get the 32 gigabyte or 64 gigabyte? Again, $20 difference in price. That's a little bit trickier in my opinion. If you'd like to save the $20, it doesn't seem like that much. The storage is probably not going to be that critical. It really depends on how many apps you think you're going to install on there. Specifically, probably games. Those take up the most storage. If you have an Apple Arcade account and you're planning on using that with your Apple TV, you might consider getting the extra amount of storage, especially if you're going to be playing a lot of games on the Apple TV. But if you don't think that's you, you don't think you're going to be installing a lot of apps, you probably could get away with the 32 gigabyte model and do just fine. So that kind of answers, I think and hope, the first question for you, Scott. On that second question, what are the advantages for an Apple TV? I think a place to start is if it's going to be just for streaming content, specifically just for watching Apple TV Plus content, I'm not sure there is much of an advantage to getting an Apple TV versus any other device or going with another option. At this point, as we talked about earlier in the podcast, there are a lot of new television sets that have the Apple TV app built in, and they will be able to stream and watch Apple TV Plus content just fine without any extra additional hardware or additional cost. You also have some lower cost options in terms of set-top devices or stick devices, if you go with the Amazon, but you have Roku, you have Amazon Fire TV, and you can get those devices for as low as about $30 or $40 if you can get a deal. And they will perfectly allow you to run the Apple TV software and access Apple TV Plus content. So those could be a good option. Now, the flip side of that is if you have a lot of Apple TV content, you've bought a lot of movies and TV shows from iTunes. Maybe you have a lot of iOS games and applications that you'd like to use with your Apple TV, you know, games and apps that have Apple TV versions. If you have the Apple Arcade service, if you want to access your cable and other streaming content with a single user experience, user interface across all of your Apple devices, these are all great reasons for opting to go with an Apple TV. And as a matter of fact, that's why I love my Apple TV, is because it is the kind of one place, and I am so invested in Apple technology across the board. It just makes it simple and easy to use. The experience is consistent. It gets continually better. Apple continues to improve it. And I'm invested in the Apple ecosystem. I have an Apple Arcade account, and playing games on the Apple TV is a lot of fun, especially when you throw in a couple of made for iPhone, you know, MFI controllers. It doesn't replace, I would say, a gaming console if you're really into that kind of gaming. It's definitely much more casual gaming, although it is increasing. It is getting a little more serious, but still, I wouldn't say it's anything equivalent to, say, like a Nintendo or an Xbox. I'm not going to compare it to that, but it is certainly a lot of fun, and it's great to have an Apple TV for that. With the Apple TV, you know, you still do need to install the various applications to access your different services, especially if you have, you know, a cable subscription and you want to access live TV and apps like NBC and CBS and ABC. You're still going to need to install all those individual apps, or at least use the new Apple TV channels to subscribe to those services. But once you have it all installed, the Apple TV app interface is okay for kind of consolidating everything together, a lot of your content, but maybe not all of it. I have generally found that it's better for stuff that you're actively watching, or if you know what you want to watch and can search for it. When it comes to simply browsing or trying to find new content through recommendations, as we've talked about here on the in the past on the MacCast, it is not that great. It used to be a lot better, but now they've kind of fragmented it a bit. A lot of the recommendations suffer from the fact that you get recommended stuff in channels or in apps that you maybe don't have access to, or content that you don't subscribe to. And that's incredibly frustrating. It feels like they're trying to constantly upsell you on other services. And I really don't like that part of the experience. But, you know, you can always jump out and go just to the individual apps if you want to browse around. So I am finding that I do have to do that, especially with apps and gaps in the service for things like Netflix, who don't participate in the Apple TV integration. That is a bit frustrating as well. So I think there's room for improvement, but overall, it's a pretty good experience, and it's a nice device. Again, if you really want that consistent Apple experience, I think it really is the only way to go. You're not going to get that with a Roku or an Amazon device. Again, those devices have the same kind of functionality. With Roku and Amazon, you're going to have individual apps for all the different subscription services that you subscribe to, you know, video services you subscribe to, and also to access all of the different channels. Another area that is a little bit tricky with the Apple TV, although again it changes if you subscribe to individual services, is like live television and you know, live stuff like sports. For myself, I currently have access to a number of streaming services. I have Netflix, I have Disney Plus, Hulu, and ESPN through their bundle, and I have Amazon Prime Video. And between those three services, I have plenty of streaming content to watch. Oh, and of course, Apple TV Plus. So I guess that's the fourth. So between those four services, I am not wanting for things to watch. I have plenty of content to consume and watch. Add into that, you know, content that I purchase through iTunes, either TV shows or movies. And I don't feel like I even need to have a cable subscription. The one thing that I lose out on there is live TV, and also live special events are often frustrating. So if we want to see an award show, or maybe we want to see holiday stuff like the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade, or say the Rose Parade, we really don't have access to that. Another big frustrating one, especially on New Year's, is to the live, you know, coverage of the ball drop in New York. We don't get to get that kind of stuff because I don't have a cable subscription. Another frustration is sports. I know I now have ESPN, but that is somewhat limited, as you probably know. But the good news is, for sports, many of the leagues have their own subscription plans. So MLB at Bat, the NHL has their own thing that you can sign up for. So if you sign up for those, they all have their own individual apps, and you can stream those through the Apple TV just fine. So, you know, personally, I love my Apple TV. I think it is a great device. They are a little bit more expensive, but again, I think what you're paying for is the same thing that you always pay for with Apple, and that is that great ease of use and user experience. Now, I'm not going to go into the remote. I guess as we're talking about user experience, a lot of people really hate the Apple remote. I am not that passionate about it. I don't think it's that bad. If you don't like it, though, a great option is just to use an iPhone. Great reuse for an old iPhone is just throwing the Apple remote app on there and using that as your remote device. And that is a great experience. So there are ways to work around that one. But yeah, I think if, you know, you're looking for something for Apple TV Plus and you want to do more than just stream the Apple TV Plus content, more Apple-like things like Apple Arcade or maybe iOS apps and things like that, yeah, you can consider getting an Apple TV. If it's really just going to be kind of to stream things to your television without having to AirPlay them or something like that, then, you know, pick up maybe a Fire TV stick and just use that. Or maybe it's something that's already built into your TV set. That might be worth it, worth looking into. So I hope that helps kind of answer your questions, maybe gets into the whole streaming and what is Apple TV good for kind of conversation. I'm sure others in the community have thoughts and opinions on this. If you do, shoot us some feedback, send us an email, maccast@gmail.com. So this next thing is something that surprised me this week. It was something that I didn't even know was a thing, but I had a listener write in and he was a little bit frustrated and said, "Hey, I don't know how to clean the keyboard on my new MacBook Air." And that took me back for a second because I thought, well, this is pretty straightforward, right? You power it off and you just, you know, take a damp cloth, not too wet, right? But, and you just go over it with the soft, lint-free cloth, clean it up a little bit, and then power it back on, and away you go. Well, apparently, the newer MacBook Pros and MacBook Air models, the ones introduced in 2018 or later, they have a great new feature, and I'm doing air quotes here, feature, where if you press any key on the keyboard or you press the trackpad, they just power on. So that actually creates an issue because you can't wipe down or clean the keyboard on your Mac without actually turning the device on. And in general, it's recommended, or I've always recommended in the past, that if you are cleaning your Mac, that you do power it off. Way back in olden times, we could do even one better because we could actually remove the battery from the device and cut power to it completely. Of course, those days are long gone, but at least, you know, with, say, my 2015 MacBook Pro, I can shut it down, make sure it's completely powered off, and clean the keyboard. As long as I avoid hitting the power key, it's not going to power on. That is no longer the case with these new model MacBook Pros and MacBook Airs. So the question was, what to do? Because the other problem is, if it's powered on and it's not in, you know, some sort of other mode, you could, you know, be typing keys or pressing keys and entering data into your device, and weird things can happen, right? There's certain key combinations where stuff happens in the Finder, and you probably don't want that stuff going on either. So a couple of things I think you can possibly do. One trick is to drop the Mac back into its lock screen mode. So if you go under the Apple menu and choose lock screen, I think it's Command Option Q, you can go back to the lock screen and you can then clean your keyboard without the fear of any kind of keyboard presses going in there. Of course, you're going to have to avoid accidentally, you know, sort of swiping or wiping in your password, but if you have a good strong password, which you should, the odds of that happening should be slim to none. So that would be one way you could handle cleaning your keyboard. Again, you're not going to have it fully powered off, so if you are using any kind of liquid, personally, I stick to just plain water. Don't use any solvents or any harsh cleansers for sure. I always spray that onto a lint-free cloth and do it very lightly. You don't want to use a lot of moisture. Go over it, and especially do not use a lot of moisture if you have to clean your Mac with it still powered on. Be very, very careful about that. Another option pointed out by The Loop was a bit of software that you can use called Keyboard Clean Tool. I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. But what this software does is that when you activate it, it simply locks any keyboard input until you actually click a button on the modal dialog that comes up. So you launch the software, it locks out all key presses, and then you actually have to click a button to reactivate any key presses. So this would actually be really good for any Mac out there, not just the newer ones. Again, again, if you wanted to be able to sort of wipe down the keyboard or mash down a bunch of keys all at the same time while your Mac is still up and running. Beyond that, I don't really know what you do, especially if you want to be able to clean your keyboard with your Mac completely powered off. As far as I know, and from the research I was able to do, there really is no workaround. If you know differently, if you know a trick for this with these newer model Macs, shoot me an email, send me an audio comment, maccast@gmail.com. I would love to figure this out and share a solution or share solutions on a future episode of the MacCast. And then finally for this week, a thing of the moment. Now, I often don't do, or I don't think I ever have done a thing of the moment that wasn't something that I own or have used, but I want to make an exception this time around because this thing is too darn cool, especially if you're an old school Apple fan. It's something that was shown off at CES, and it is called SmartyKit. I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com, but it's SmartyKit, S-M-A-R-T-Y, kit, K-I-T, .io. And what this is it's a do-it-yourself kit that gives you everything that you need to build your own Apple One replica computer. And I'm saying this sort of tongue-in-cheek because it's kind of the updated version of an Apple One computer. It's on a teeny tiny breadboard. It has all the chips that you need. There is no soldering required in assembling the kit. And all of the chips come in numbered bags, kind of like Lego kits, so you don't have any problems finding the parts you need and sort of assembling everything together. It gives you all of the instructions. Comes with the breadboards, 15 different chips with firmware, jumper wires, colored cables, PS2 and RCA sockets for the keyboard and video monitor, and a battery holder. It's actually powered by 4 AA batteries. So it is a much smaller version of the Apple One, again, because modern technology allows it to be smaller, but it's essentially all of the same components. It has the same 1 MHz MOS 6502 processor that was used in the original Apple One. And the ROM has a copy of Steve Wozniak's original monitor operating system. You do need to bring your own keyboard and monitor. Like I said, that includes a PS2 keyboard, which may be hard to come by. So if you don't have that, you are going to need to bring your own adapters. You also need an adapter to adapt the RCA video out to something that's maybe a little bit more modern. Again, unless you have a way to plug that in, maybe you have an old television lying around or something like that. But it's really cool. The thing will run basic. They also say they have a lightweight version of Python that you can run on the system as well. There is no launch date available for it yet, but when it is released, they say they're going to sell for about $99 US. So I thought this was pretty cool. Build your own Apple One with a little kit, SmartyKit, SmartyKit.io. Check it out. And that is the thing of the moment. But with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a moment and thank my show sponsor, Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, also Text Expander for iPhone and iPad, along with PDF Pen for iOS. You can check out all of their great software. Get more information and details by visiting smilesoftware.com/podcast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cachefly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. You'll find them at backbeatmedia.com. As always, I love hearing from you. If you have a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you can send your emails and audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You're also welcome to call in on the listener hotline. That phone number, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And if you want to follow me online between shows, you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast, or you could check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast. But that is going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.